You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
I just cannot believe that it's over between me and Steve, you know? I mean, maybe there's still hope.
Not so long ago, if you found yourself anxious or depressed or hysterical, you could pour out your troubles to your pastor or your bartender. If you were really serious about your problems, though, and you had the money, you'd probably lie down and start talking.
There seems to be a definite pattern emerging. And of course, this pattern, once isolated, can be coped with.
Psychoanalysis was a revolution at the turn of the century, and not everybody liked Sigmund Freud's talking cure. Among other things, Freud convinced us that even the best of our families were full of rage and repression and all kinds of lusts.
Hi, Bill. Want a ride?
Sure, Missy. I mean, Mom.
Stepmom's cute.
Shut up, Ted.
You know when she was a senior and we were freshmen?
Shut up, Ted.
For most of the 20th century, psychoanalysis had a huge impact on American culture, like that voiceover that tells us what was wrong with Norman Bates at the end of Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho.
Now, to understand it the way I understood it, hearing it from the mother, that is, from the mother half of Norman's mind, you have to go back 10 years.
Frequent trips to the shrink's couch started to seem slow and expensive and quaint when medicines like Prozac started appearing. That was in the late 80s and 90s, and before long, the cover of Time magazine was asking, is Freud dead? But one way or another, we are still today enthralled to Freud, not least on television, where we relish our glimpses into the psychoanalytic sessions of a certain guilt-racked mobster.
I could be going to the camp for the rest of my f***ing life, and I'm not supposed to discuss it with my psychiatrist? What the f*** are you for, anyway?
How does that make you feel, the idea that you might be sent to prison?
We are talking about Sigmund Freud's long shadow today in Studio 360. Jonathan Lear is my guest. Dr. Lear is a practicing psychoanalyst and a philosopher. He has written about how psychoanalysis applies to love, happiness, life, death, pretty much all the big stuff. Jonathan Lear, welcome to Studio 360.
Hello. Hi.
Are you a fan of The Sopranos?
I love The Sopranos. I think it's a great show. And I also very much like the way the psychotherapy is portrayed on the show.
Really? Is it realistic?
I don't think it's realistic in some sense. I mean, there's a kind of speed to it that doesn't fit my own experience of it. But what I do think is very realistic about it is that Tony Soprano is somebody who is wrestling with some handful of problems that go back to early life and seem to still be alive in the present. And they're coming out in the conversations. And that does seem to me to be very well done.
So I guess the creators of that show have a Freudian explanation for what this guy is as we see him today.
Well, I think so. I mean, Robin Green and Mitchell Burgess, I think are their names, they're the producers, and I think they've written a lot of the shows. And the American Psychoanalytic Association gave them an award for, I think, being the best portrayal of psychiatry or psychotherapy ever done. And when they accepted the award, they both said that they had been in psychotherapy, it had helped them. They had gained insight into not just themselves, but the dynamic nature of the mind's workings. And they had tried to sort of turn that into television reality.
Now, before we go any further in this program, I need to ask you, what is psychoanalysis as opposed to all the various forms of therapy that people know about or think they know about?
Well, I think that's a really good question. And I think that's partly why when you asked me about The Sopranos, what would one call that? Tony is not going in and lying down on the couch. I think it's very influenced by Freud. It's very influenced by psychoanalysis. But they're sitting up. I would guess they meet once a week for conversations. There's a lot of back and forth between Dr. Melfi where she's giving a lot of reactions. So I would call that a dynamically minded, psychoanalytically informed psychotherapy.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, well, that's what's of interest there is what are the conflicts in the mind that Tony might not be aware of that she can help him bring to the fore and see how that's getting manifested in his current life.
And we see his dreams a lot, too. Is that a residue of the Freudian way of thinking about how the mind works?
Definitely. It's actually, I've been studying dream life in other cultures through history, and one of the things I've come to see is that it's only very recently and for an extraordinarily short period of time that people think, well, dreams are not that important or they're, you know, random or nothing really to pay attention to. I mean, by and large, humans have thought that dream life is extraordinarily important, and cultures have thought that it provides some kind of a message from the world of spirits or giving certain great prophetic powers into the future. What Freud did was to take up this pervasive human phenomenon and also to take up the sense that I think is just shared throughout, you know, human history, that this is a very significant and revealing phenomenon, and tried to provide systematic account of how it might come together without invoking the gods or, you know, extra spirits and saying, well, this is, you know, Shakespeare said that fault is not in our stars but in ourselves. I mean, trying to see how these phenomena are meaningful phenomena. They tell us something about ourselves, but we are the generators of it.
My guest today is Jonathan Lear, who is a psychoanalyst and author and philosopher. Civilians like me use Freudian terms all the time without even realizing. And I wonder if you get people coming into your office talking about their ego or their anal retentive wife or their controlling mother.
Everybody has that lingo.
Yeah.
I mean, by and large, my experience is when people have a story to tell that involves psychological concepts about what they're like, they usually use that narrative as a defense against actually trying to find out what they're like.
And, interesting.
I actually think that, you know, psychological discourse, you know, I'm this kind of a person or whatever, is by and large used as, you know, psychoanalysts have this term of art called defense. And I think it's a very prominent, you know, so-called insight into oneself is a huge defense against insight into oneself.
Well, that almost sounds like a Buddhist koan or something. But,
well, you know, the Buddhists had something going for them with their koans.
And they do today still. Yeah. Speaking of throwing around Freudian terminology a lot, there is a new video game that we've discovered. It's called Psychonauts. It takes players through the psyches of inmates at an insane asylum, and the point of the game is to try to resolve the inmates' inner conflicts. Tim Schafer is the creator of Psychonauts. He told us about trying to program the warp and woof of the human soul onto a game disc.
A long time ago, back at UC Santa Cruz, I took a psychology of dreams class, and we were studying case studies of people who have something going on in their life, something maybe traumatic, but in their dreams, they would take different forms. They'd be like bears attacking them or their house. They couldn't fix up their house. And, you know, through some sort of analysis, they made this connection between the house and their image of their own body or the bear and their memories of their father when they were a kid.
You gotta help me protect the bunnies!
I just got more and more interested in this because these are regular people and they're creating kind of poetic symbols for what's going on in their life.
Bunnies.
Years later, it came as an idea for a game where you could jump into someone's head and actually interact with these symbols. Since it's an imaginary world, you can have any visual you want.
I see a small, bunny-like animal thing.
And anything can happen, because it all just has to follow his dream logic.
That's right, baby. Daddy's here.
But that dream logic all means something. So when you find that bear, or you see that rundown house, it's a symbol for something. There's Edgar Tegley, who is obsessed with black velvet painting, and you meet him in the art therapy room of this insane asylum. And you need him to paint a painting for you for some other gameplay reason, but he can't paint anything except for bullfights and matadors.
The matador! The bull!
And every time he tries, he becomes incredibly violent.
That is why I am here, chained in more ways than you can see.
A prisoner of art.
A prisoner of art.
When you go into his mind, the entire world you find in there is created out of black velvet, with day glow colors and a bull running through town. and there's a flamenco dancer. There's some dogs playing poker. And you gradually uncover the story of Edgar was a famous painter who was in love with this flamenco dancer, but it was stolen away by the infamous matador playboy, Dingo in Flagrante. Then you find a manhole cover, and you go down into the sewers of Edgar's mind. And you find deeper memories where he actually wasn't a famous painter at all.
He used to be the captain of his high school wrestling team.
And his girlfriend was a cheerleader who left him for this male cheerleader.
Give me a G!
G!
Give me an O!
O!
Give me a B!
They stole my happiness!
Give me an L!
My life!
Give me an O!
The state semifinals! Everything!
Balls!
And you gradually piece together the story of how he romanticized that teenage heartbreak into this really dramatic story about a flamenco dancer and a bullfighter. None of it was true. And you kind of, as a player, help him fight the bull.
Edgar?
When the bull deflates, you see it has Edgar's face on it, and it's like one of those dream symbols. You could say that it stood for his rage over this years-old heartache.
Can't you just let it go?
How embarrassing. I can't believe I was hung up for so long over these losers.
I was talking to someone once who said, you know, their way of dealing with difficult people was that they tried to see that inside that person there's something they're afraid of. And once she gets a hold of that fear in that person, she has more empathy for the situation. They don't seem like so much of a jerk, and she can deal with them. And so in the game, we have characters like that who are not just jerks, but they're, you know, actively trying to steal the brains of all these kids at the camp and take over the world, you know? So, and you understand them a lot more because you've been inside their head. You've seen their personal demons. You've fought their nightmares, you know, and you've seen what they're most afraid of.
It's not safe. He's coming.
Who's coming?
My dad.
Your dad? The butcher?
You have to fight this butcher who was represents the main bad guy's fear of his father.
He says little bunnies are good for nothing. Nothing but food.
Here, little bunnies.
And my mom was a butcher when she was younger. I don't think that's relevant, but...
Tim Schafer's new video game Psychonauts is available for Xbox, PlayStation 2, and PCs. Jonathan Mitchell produced our story. Jonathan, what do you make of the fact that that game designer's mother was a butcher?
I want to know more about why little bunnies are good for nothing. This is what I meant by when I was talking about a defense. I was much more interested in the little phrases that he used, like little bunnies are good for nothing, rather than some, you know, sort of general claim about what his mother was like. One of the things I like about psychoanalysis as opposed to video games is you're not sort of imaginatively jumping into a weird world. You're listening to a person who's reporting their dream, but you're also sort of firmly in an office with a couch and a man or a woman who's lying down and talking about it. But I mean, what I think is really fascinating about the kind of story that he's working on is the idea that there are these images that will come up in a dream. I mean, he mentioned a matador, a black velvet, a flamenco dancer. And one of the things that I think Freud really insisted on, which goes, I think, very much against the popular understanding of Freud, is that there is no fixed symbol meaning code that can be sort of applied to every person.
So as Freud famously said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, that he meant
Well, I
that.
Think he's wrong about that. He's especially wrong about himself. I mean, this was I love cigars, but he smoked, up to 20 a day in 2 decades of mouth cancer. He was still smoking.
Uh-huh.
But I think actually it's part of Freud's theory that a cigar never means just a cigar. But what is true about Freud's theory is that it never means just one other thing either.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can go home tonight and dream about cigars, and I can dream about them. But what it will mean for each of us will likely be extraordinarily idiosyncratic. And that's, I think, one of the most interesting things about his account in the interpretation of dreams, about how each individual will pick up an image or a thought. Sometimes it's just hear a word, and start turning over associations to it, make connections to it that are very, very idiosyncratic and which come out in an analytic therapy.
And when you say that part of what Freud was all about, or maybe the main thing he was all about, is that individual artifacts, people, incidents in dreams have meaning of a very idiosyncratic kind that vary from person to person. Is that, if we one were saying, here are the five key aspects of Sigmund Freud and what he has left us, is that one of them?
Oh, I do think that's one of them, absolutely. Another is a sense that individuals are extraordinarily complicated, interesting, mentally imaginative creatures. And so I think, you know, another great contribution that Freud made, and why I think, you know, as long as civilization survives, people will continue to read him, is the thought that the story about each human, the story about what's going on around us, is often beginning at the place where most people think it ends. That you read a story about what's happening in the newspaper. And in fact, I think from a, you know, Freud's point of view, a psychoanalytic point of view, there's so much more that needs to be known about what the people are like and what's motivating them.
You suggest that any individual's dreams are a venue for creativity, for making stories up that have all kinds of meanings to that person. What about people who do that professionally, artists who sometimes imagine that their creativity is dependent on that whole unconscious psychic underbrush, and they worry that if they go and sit on a couch for four or five times a week and talk to you and figure it all out, that their creativity is suddenly going to run dry. Is that a problem?
Well, it's a problem in the sense that it's a very common fantasy. I mean, not just artists. I mean, people are very worried about their creativity and what will happen to it. I mean, this too is a fantasy. It's a worry about one's potency, one's power, one's creative juices. What is often the thing that people are happiest about when they've had something they consider to be a good analysis is a newfound sense of vibrancy. Now, from an external perspective, it's very hard to see that a person feels a new creativity, a new pleasure in what they were doing before.
Uh-huh.
But that, I find, it's very highly correlated with people who have what I would think of as a successful analysis, is the return of a sense of creativity that they were lacking or had in a diminished sense before, however creative or productive they were in terms of the social world.
Jonathan Lear is a psychoanalyst and a professor of philosophy. In a minute, we'll hear about the movies that Sigmund Freud never made.
Why, it's got everything. A father complex, a mother complex, and an office complex, all in one.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by The Economist, presenting Intelligent Life, a new publication on how trends and developments in technology, medicine, and society will affect our world. Available now at Barnes & Noble and Borders Books. And by Nonesuch Records' new release, Chavez Ravine by Ry Cooder, which the LA Times calls a long glance back at a now-vanished Los Angeles at mid-century, featuring performances by East L.A. Chicano musicians of the era. Available at tower.com/nonesuch.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The psychoanalyst and author Jonathan Lear is my guest today. We have Woody Allen to thank for making the Freudian analyst a stock character in comedies.
How often do you sleep together?
Do you have sex often?
Hardly ever, maybe three times a week.
Constantly, I'd say three times a week. Like the other night, Albie wanted
to
have sex.
She would not sleep with me the other night, you know? It's just...
And I don't know, I mean, 6 months ago, I would have done it. I would have done it, just to please it.
Earlier filmmakers took Freud more seriously. Back in 1925, the movie mogul Samuel Goldwyn traveled all the way to Vienna to meet Freud. He wanted him to consult on movies for his new studio, MGM. Freud refused even to see Goldwyn. But we today can't help wishing that improbable encounter had taken place. We asked playwright David Ives to imagine it for us. Here is the world premiere of a new play, Metro-Goldwyn-Freud.
Dr. Freud, Mr. Samuel Goldwyn of Hollywood, California, to see you.
Ah, Dr. Freud.
Well, you don't have to overdo it. Do I call you Mr. Goldwyn? Unless you're seeing in triplicate or I've got a split personality, let's keep it to one Dr. Freud. Otherwise, it gets crowded in here. Now, what can I do for you? Take a couch, any couch. I'll give you 50 minutes or $100, whichever comes first.
Thank you.
Not that couch. That's my mother's couch. Hasn't been cleaned in years. And make of that what you will, as I'm sure you will anyway.
Doctor, may I call you Sigmund?
Do I call you names? You can call me whatever you want if the money's right. Now, I demand writer credit, producer credit, director credit, college credit, and a better credit rating than the one I've got. Not to mention an unlimited expense account on a Swedish production assistant in a tight sweater. Arr! Preferably female. Otherwise, you can keep her. I presume you're here to talk about the movies.
Yes, I am.
Good. If you were here to talk about psychoanalysis, we'd be in trouble. Why, it's shocking how little you know. You haven't even mentioned my sexual obsession yet, and it's practically clogging up the toilet. Oh, did I say toilet? You can see where my mind is at. And you should see my subconscious. It's too much of this psychoanalysis, which, as far as I'm concerned, is just a German word for filth. Now, where were we?
Dr. Freud, I am prepared to offer you $100,000.
Prepared to offer? Why don't you just offer it and get things out in the open? What, are you repressed or just cautious? And if you can tell me the difference, I'll give you $100,000. Now, where were we?
$100,000.
Why, that offer is insulting. It's humiliating. It's demeaning. I accept. Now, where do I sign?
For this fee, you will come...
Oh, I have to work for it now, do I? Not only a cheapskate, but a slave driver. Mitzi, call my accountant. I think I'm overdrawn.
Dr. Freud, you seem to be fixated on money.
Fixated, am I? Well, it's not surprising. I was traumatized at an early age by my father, who was poor but incoherent. Not in that order. I let him keep the poor part. Now I'm just incoherent. As you'll know, if you've read my books, I can't understand them myself, except the dirty parts, which I put in to raise my sails. So I raised my sails and turned the ship and found myself in a brothel in Amsterdam.
Doctor, I would like you to come to America and advise my company on a film about the great love stories of history.
So, trying to enlist me in one of your filthy productions, huh? How dare you? I'm honored. Why, I'm halfway to a pornographer already, but without any of the perks. And if Hollywood isn't a percolator of pornography, I don't know what it is. When do I start? What do I wear? If you say bustier, I say corset. So let's call the whole thing off.
I was thinking we could start with Antony and Cleopatra.
Wonderful. I see Adolf Manjou and Mary Pickford, but it could be something on my glasses. Do I look homosexual to you? I only ask because something my chimney sweep said at the gym the other day. But why start with Antony and Cleopatra when you can start with Oedipus and Cleopatra?
Were Oedipus and Cleopatra romantically involved?
There will be if I have anything to do with it. Can't you see those two wrestling at the Egyptian headquarters? Or is it head waiters? Anyway, I can see the advertising. Be a Freud. Be very a Freud. Why, it's got everything. A father complex, a mother complex, and an office complex, all in one. We'll set it at the pyramids and make it a love triangle. What do you think?
I think that anyone who goes to a psychiatrist ought to have his head examined.
I wish I thought of that line myself. Mitzi, get me Kaufman on the line. I'm suing him.
Doctor, did you have some strange dream last night?
Why, yes, now that you mention it. You were there, and so was my chimney sweep, with a very nasty-looking plunger. Now that I think of it, it resembled my sister.
Tell me more.
Well, it was the summer of 93, and I was just out of pigtails.
Very interesting.
Really? You should have seen the pig.
Go on.
That was Tom Robbins playing Sam Goldwyn, and Louis Stadlin as Sigmund Freud. Playwright David Ives is also the author of a new novel for young adults called Scrib. Jonathan Lear is my guest today. He is a psychoanalyst and a professor of philosophy. So, Jonathan, how might it have gone down, if not like that, if Freud had consented to meet Goldwyn?
I thought that was an absolutely accurate rendition of what happened. And I'm waiting for Oedipus and Cleopatra. It's funny. I knew that Freud had turned down an offer of $100,000, which, even now it's a lot of money, but in 1925 that was just a huge amount of money to come talk to Samuel Goldwyn about making a movie. He also turned down, I think the year before, it's less, but still a lot of money, $25,000 that the Chicago Tribune in Chicago offered him to come psychoanalyze Leopold and Loeb. So he was turning down American offers of cash left and right.
Why do you think?
My sense is the real, if you really want insight into this, the place to look now would be the current tremendous anti-American feeling in Europe and France and Germany. There's a very strong hostility to a kind of crassness and pushiness of American life, of vulgarity that don't really understand the European mind. And
oh, that.
I must say, if you, that's my view about what Freud was like. He was a European of the, you know, he flourished in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. In Vienna, a Jew who suffered tremendous discrimination, the rise of anti-Semitism, he lived through all of that, and he could read Latin and Greek. He read Sophocles in Greek. This was a man who loved Europe, suffered Europe, was a manifestation of Europe, and I think he just thought America was a, you know, a vulgar place where people didn't really know anything or care about anything important.
And I guess in the case of Goldwyn, where a fellow Jew has who had left Europe and gone to make his millions in America might have peeved him even more.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting to me because on the one hand, I think the psychoanalytic insights he had are incredibly democratic in spirit, in the sense that it's basically saying each individual person is fascinating. They've got the sort of depths and conflicts and issues that, you know, usually are reserved for the great heroes of dramatic literature and myth. What Freud is saying, look, we're all, each of us has this going on in him or her. And he was somebody, I mean, extraordinarily for his time and for whatever, you know, one might want to fault him in various ways he treated people and his technique and whatever. He was somebody who was willing to listen to basically anybody and felt that he could learn the secrets of the human soul by listening to, you know, 19, 20-year-old haute bourgeois Viennese girls who were, you know, upset and complaining. So on the one hand, there's this huge, I think, democratic impulse at the heart of Freudian psychoanalysis. And on the other hand, and maybe these, actually now that I'm saying it, maybe these things go together, he had a real suspicion, I think, of the commercial, democratic sort of bustle of, American life. There's something about that that just offended a kind of aristocratic European sensibility.
And probably would have hated all depictions of his, of psychoanalysis in the film, in movies. Has it been, in your view, other than The Sopranos, done particularly well in film?
Well, I must say, I think one of the best things ever said about psychoanalysis was said by Ingrid Bergman in the Alfred Hitchcock film, I think it's Spellbound, where she said, I think this is a quote, she said, you know, psychoanalysis treats the emotional problems of the sane. That's Ingrid Bergman.
And, playing a psychiatrist.
She is a psychoanalyst in that movie. Yeah. She's fantastic, I think. I mean, the movie itself is a, you know, wild distortion and fantasy of what psychoanalysis is like, but there are some really good one-liners.
I think of novels I've read, and there are a kind of disproportionate number that involve the psychoanalytic relationship, Philip Roth, Portnoy's Complaint being chief among them. And I'm wondering, as we were thinking about this show, if is that because psychoanalysis, as you say, was such a central part of American culture in the middle of the century, or is it also because it's a kind of neat trick for the writer to have the inner thoughts of a hero so sort of easily served up?
Well, you know, it's funny, as you were saying that, I mean, psychoanalysts sort of think about associations. And one of the things I was associating to is not just Philip Roth, where the explicit issue is about a relationship, you know, a complaint that's being spoken to an analyst. But what was the literature, the great literature, the great novels being written at the same time Freud is flourishing as an analyst? And I mean, one that comes immediately to my mind is Proust, the uh-huh. In Search of Lost Time. Another is Ulysses. And if you, you know, I think, I mean, it's a very interesting question to ask, you know, what could you learn about dreams and how they actually work if Freud had never written The Interpretation of Dreams, but you did have Proust, and you were trying to figure out how dreams worked on the basis of that, or you did have the dream sequences from Ulysses. These are people all at the same time are trying to, one of the things they're really noticing is this magnificent associative, imaginative linkings that the human mind does when it's allowed to just sort of wander in a dreamlike way.
My guest is Jonathan Lear, who is a psychoanalyst and a philosopher. Freud died in September 1939. He was suffering from a painful cancer of the mouth, and his life ended with what we would call today an assisted suicide. It was just weeks after World War II started. That November, the poet W.H. Auden wrote an elegy for Freud that was deeply colored by the war.
When there are so many, we shall have to mourn. When grief has been made so public and exposed to the critique of a whole epoch, the frailty of our conscience and anguish, of whom shall we speak? For every day they die among us, those who were doing us some good, who knew it was never enough, but hoped to improve a little by living. Such was this doctor.
50 years later, Auden's poem fell into the hands of a painter named Spencer Finch. Finch loved Auden's work, and he carried the elegy for Freud around with him everywhere he went. He explained to Curtis Fox how this poem finally led him to the couch in Freud's study.
So when I was in therapy, when we talked about what my goals were and what I was interested in getting out of therapy, I brought this poem in, which she wasn't familiar with, which I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe any sort of Freudian didn't know this poem. And really what I said on a sort of general level, what I was interested in was what Auden said, which is the goal was to be able to, approach the future as a friend without a wardrobe,
of excuses, without a set mask of rectitude or an embarrassing, over-familiar gesture.
I still have a wardrobe of excuses, but it's a slightly smaller wardrobe now.
Spencer Finch is known for paintings and installations that try to capture the particular qualities of the light in specific locations, like the color of dawn at Troy, or what the Grand Canyon looked like at various times of day when he had his eyes closed. Auden's poem got him to thinking about what the Wolfman and Dora and what any of Freud's patients looked at when they spent hour after hour with Freud in his office.
So I decided I would go to Vienna and go to the Freud house. What I did was I worked in Freud's examination room where the couch was, although the couch had moved around. The room was totally empty, like a doctor's examination room. But of course, when you see the photographs, he had all this stuff around. I mean, he had so much chotch. It was unbelievable. This, all of this
statues,
to look at. So the only place where there wasn't anything was on the ceiling. It was the only blank spot in the whole room.
So the empty ceiling in Sigmund Freud's Vienna office, the same part of the ceiling that Freud's patients stared at while lying on his famous couch, this became the subject of his piece. Getting to work, he positioned himself so that his head was at the same height as the heads being examined by Dr. Freud.
And I looked at the ceiling, it was a white ceiling, and did pastel drawings based on the color of the light of the ceiling at different times of the day. So I started at 8 in the morning and went till, I think, around 7 at night. So there are about 12 of these drawings that were about 3 feet across and in the shape of an oval. The oval refers to the view of the person being analyzed, the NL's end. And that was it. They were just these sort of gray ovals with some ochre in some of them, some sienna in darker ones, and they're a little lighter on the right edge because that's closer to the window and darker on the left edge. And the ones in the middle of the day are lighter and brighter, and the ones towards the beginning and end of the day are darker.
Finch did one drawing an hour, beginning a new one at the top of each hour, sort of like a therapist starting a session with a fresh patient. Between drawings, he got to know the employees of the Freud house as they took turns babysitting him.
I was very interested in the sort of psychology of working at the Freud Museum. And one woman who worked in the library really sort of gave me the whole story on how everyone was just really angry with everyone and how the director was really mean and how she was in Freudian analysis. And, well, she's really, it's not helping her much. She really should be getting more intensive therapy. So I was like, open this whole can of worms. But it sounds like it was like, you know, any other office, but probably worse in some way.
In his elegy, Auden celebrates Freud's exploration of the richness, the deep personal weirdness of every human mind. Writing at the end of the 1930s, Auden viewed Freud as politically very significant. He thought that Freudian ideas were already acting as a bulwark against the rise of totalitarianism, which wanted to wipe out traces of individuality in the service of the state. In the poem, he called it the generalized life.
No wonder the ancient cultures of conceit, in his technique of unsettlement, foresaw the fall of princes, the collapse of their lucrative patterns of frustration. If he succeeded, why, the generalized life would become impossible. The monolith of state be broken and prevented the cooperation of avengers.
So this idea of the generalized life, that everything should be understood, everything should be the same, the light should be the same in the morning, noon, and night, everyone should be the same and everyone should follow these rules, and there's a right and there is a wrong. And there is a specific photographic representation that is the truth, and that there is one way that is the only way. And I think he was opposed to that.
Finch eventually took his pastel drawings back home, and then he created four frescoes of Sigmund Freud's ceiling. It's hard to tell the differences in light between them because they're now in different places. One he still owns. One is hanging over the couch in the apartment of some friends. One is in a collection in Connecticut. And one belongs to a collector in New York who is in intensive psychotherapy. But Finch is by no means done with Freud, who remains one of his touchstones, artistically and spiritually.
There's still something incredibly liberating about Freudian psychology, as I understand it, which is to sort of embrace the richness of life and not freak out about it. I mean, I don't think he literally said that anywhere, but that's sort of what I take from it.
For Studio 360, I'm Curtis Fox.
You can find out more about Spencer Finch and the Freud House at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson. My guest today is Jonathan Lear, the psychoanalyst and author. Jonathan, I assume you've been to the Freud House?
I have.
What's it like?
Well, the line that that Spencer Finch used that seemed to really resonate with me was when he said, you know, there's so much chotch around, unbelievable. Freud loved archaeology, and he part of his theory of the mind was that it was digging, like it was like an archaeological excavation.
Uh-huh.
So he had tons of little, you know, ancient statues from all over, you know, the ancient world that they were around in a collection. And I must say, when I saw them, it really put me off. I thought, you know, one can argue about technique, but I thought it was bad technique to have so much, as Spencer Finch said, chotch around. It was
really? So the patients would see all this stuff and it would interrupt their train of thought?
I think it was, unconsciously, I think it was too directive. I don't like therapists' offices when they're full of, you know, ancient ruins of some sort or other. I think it suggests too much to the patient, an image of what they're there to do. And, you know, I don't think there should be that kind of suggestiveness. That's why I love the idea of just sort of looking up at the ceiling, which is a sort of blank space that that Mr. Finch put different sort of colors and ovals on. I think it's quite a lovely thing to do. I'd actually would have been interested to hear from him just the answer to the question you asked me about his sense of his creativity and his psychotherapy or analysis. It sounds to me like this is a man who's going great guns.
Absolutely. The psychoanalyst and author Jonathan Lear is my guest today. In a minute, we'll hear about bicycles with no brakes at all. Is that a Freudian death wish or just really cool design? This is Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Well, I found myself alone, hoping someone would miss me. Thinking about my home and the last home to kiss me.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by The Economist, presenting Intelligent Life, a new publication on how trends and developments in technology, medicine, and society will affect our world. Available now at Barnes & Noble and Borders Books. And by Nonesuch Records' new release, Chavez Ravine by Ry Cooder, which the LA Times calls a long glance back at a now-vanished Los Angeles at mid-century, featuring performances by East L.A. Chicano musicians of the era. Available at tower.com/nonesuch.
Mm-hmm.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I'm talking about Freud and his legacy with the psychoanalyst and author Jonathan Lear. Jonathan, at the beginning of the 20th century, when Freud was practicing and becoming influential, the great modern advertising and marketing business was also growing and flourishing and being invented, and advertising professionals very consciously thought they were using Freud's ideas to touch and provoke and manipulate our unconscious desires to want things and buy things. Do you see that as a true story of how the 20th century has unfolded?
Well, there's a grain of truth in it, and I might as well talk about the grain, which is when Freud wrote The Interpretation of Dreams, there wasn't anything, in the first edition, there was no discussion about, we were talking earlier, what a cigar meant. There was no discussion of what a particular symbol was the fixed meaning of it. But then I've forgotten the date offhand, but I think it was around 1912, a man named Stekel wrote a book about symbolism, and Freud got very excited about this book, and he wanted to write what was basically a long footnote to add to a later edition. But his insertion of this piece was so long that it just, instead of getting put at the end or as a footnote, it got put as a separate section of the book. And that's the part of the book that basically popular culture remembers. And there he was trying to come up with a fixed code. And there's the grain of truth in it is that, it is true that we are embodied creatures. It is true that our earliest experiences are going to be of, being held, taking in food from the mouth, excreting it in different ways, and that these are sort of shared experiences, and one ought to expect that although there will be variations, there's also going to be certain commonalities. And so, that I think is what got taken up.
And when as I was yesterday riding on the subway and seeing an ad for Budweiser and seeing an attractive young man nuzzling close in the advertisement to an attractive young woman as she embraced a giant bottle of Budweiser, should I attribute that image to Freudian ideas?
I'm just tempted to ask you what you thought when you saw it. Well, you're asking me what you should have done. I mean, I'm not sure what you should have
done. I wanted a beer. I mean, the cartoonishness of this giant phallic thing that this woman about to give in to the man's desires was grasping seemed, I wasn't sure if it was self-consciously Freudian or making a joke about it, or I wasn't supposed to notice that she had her arms around this cold, wet cylinder or what.
Yeah,
it seemed to me, as I was thinking about talking to you and about Freud, Freud relevant somehow.
Yeah, I associate to is the word kitsch. I mean, it does sound like a kind of sentimental, if only things were that simple.
Yeah. I think our 50 minutes are up, I guess I have to say. And thank you very much for joining me today.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you.
Jonathan Lear is a professor of philosophy at the University of Chicago and a practicing psychoanalyst. He's the author of Open-Minded, Working Out the Logic of the Soul. His brand new book is called Freud. You can find out more about him and all the stories you heard today at studio360.org.
There is a house of cards where castles stood. Now we call it home. Always Vienna, always my Martha, always the Tennessee.
Remember a few years ago how we started hearing the phrases be in the moment and live in the moment all the time? Usually it's one step in somebody's scheme of how to be happier. And it's a cliche, as a matter of fact, that I happen to believe. But originally, that phrase had nothing to do with being happy. It comes out of method acting, the invention of the Russian theater director Konstantin Stanislavski. Stanislavski's method has been the method for American actors for years and years. As part of our series now on how art works, DeMay Roberts spoke with some actors and directors in Portland, Oregon about what it means to be in the moment.
It was 1947. The play was Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire. A 23-year-old unknown actor staggered across the stage in a torn T-shirt with sweat dripping, about to have the greatest emotional moment in American theater.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
Marlon Brando's primal scream declared the dawn of method acting. From that moment on, every young actor would study the method to reach down into their psyche to find emotional truth in themselves rather than portray the emotion. Director Stephen Alexander says that before Brando's gut-wrenching performance, actors were not expected to be in the moment.
Laurence Olivier was known for saying a phrase, "I never cried a real tear on stage," but he knew how to emulate a tear to make us believe it. Whereas in many ways, American methodology encourages to find that real tear.
Finding that real tear involves a series of psychological techniques to get the actor to discover an emotion rather than portray it. Say you need to get angry for a character.
You have to be very, very angry. And you can think about how angry you were last week when somebody cut you off on the freeway.
That's called emotional recall. Actress Karen Graham also chooses active verbs to find an emotion.
And I'm trying to convince my mother of something, for instance, as the character, then if I am truly convincing her, then I am in the moment, and that helps me to be more specific about the process of doing.
In the method, acting is reacting. Director Barry Hunt finds the most important technique is listening to your fellow actors to find your emotional response.
You're very focused on their behavior, their performance in a sense, and allowing them to make your performance.
Stephen Alexander says listening and responding is key to emotional discovery, whether you're performing a monologue from Shakespeare or Maria in The Sound of Music.
What is it you're saying? Why are you discovering raindrops on roses? You have 7 kids. Who are you saying that to? How are they relating to each other? What is it you're trying to get from or do to somebody by saying
raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper...
Teacher Sanford Meisner developed the most famous exercise for staying in the moment. Actors have to repeat a phrase like, "You have nice eyes, you have nice eyes, you have nice eyes," to each other till actors react on impulse rather than thinking. Stephen Alexander says writer David Mamet, a student of Meisner, still uses this technique.
And you'll see in movies like Glengarry Glen Ross what seem like to be a Meisner repetition exercise that has become part of his storytelling.
You're going to steal the lead.
Have I said that?
Are you?
Did I say that?
Did you talk to Grant?
What did I say?
What did he say?
What did he say?
But in the course of it, you're telling a story through that active, I have to be here now, feeling of rapid dialogue.
They come to you. You're going to turn me in?
Why would they come to me?
They're going to come to everybody.
Why would I do it?
You wouldn't, George. That's why I'm talking to you now.
In that rapid dialogue, we move more toward the impulse, having to act immediately, and monitoring ourselves, censoring ourselves less as people.
When they come to me, if I have to go in there, and if I get caught, they come to me.
You don't have to go in.
I have to go in, see, that's something I have to do.
Acting on impulse creates good in-the-moment drama, but as director Barry Hunt says, that's not always good in real life.
Real life does sometimes require you to think before you speak and use other social skills. And in theater, there's a safety net because the other artist is asking you to stimulate them to a heightened level. And this is where theater is not real life.
So in real life, you can't be in the moment every moment, can you? I don't know. Can you? I don't know. Why would you want to? For Studio 360, I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
You can find out more about method acting on our website, studio360.org. That story was made possible by a grant from the Regional Arts and Culture Council. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Now, I know it's July, but I still haven't tuned up my bicycle for the season. And I've got a mess on my hands. The thing is covered with a film of oily dust and bits of rust. The brakes are out of whack. The chain is wedged between the sprockets. If I had a fixed gear bike, it'd be a lot simpler to take care of. No gears, no brakes either. In today's Design for the Real World, amateur racer Naz Hamid explains how it reduces the high-tech modern bike to its most basic machinery.
Most bikes have 2 shifters. Essentially what it does is it just shifts the chain to cover all the different permutations of the gears. Typically on an older bike, like a 10-speed, there's two changelings up front. So there's a big one and a smaller one. And on the back, there's five, what you call cogs or a sprocket. So how it works is the bigger the changeling up front and the smaller the cog in the back, the harder the gear is. The fixed gear, it's a very simple machine. It doesn't have any gears except one. And that gear is the gear that you're always in. It's like when you were a kid and you had the little big wheel. In essence, that was a fixed gear because when you turned the pedals, the big wheel would go. And when you stopped, it wouldn't go. This is my newest bike. This is basically a track flame. And it has a much steeper and tighter geometry, so it's very twitchy. It's much more responsive, which is why a lot of messengers who ride in precarious situations in the city amongst cars, amongst traffic, choose the fixed gear style bike. Most people like to describe it as being sort of stealthy. It's incredibly quiet because the chain is lined up perfectly. Normal bicycles coast. You know, you pedal, you relax your feet, the bike goes, you pedal some more, it keeps going when you start slowing down. Fixed gears don't coast. So your legs are always going. There's no stopping, there's no relaxing them, they're just always in motion. It's a hurdle to overcome, mentally. But I think once you get it, it really becomes effortless. Because now you just have this idea that, oh, my legs are always in motion, they're always spinning. You don't have to think about gears. You don't have to think about switching. You just go and you stop. It just works. When you take a hill, you start to notice that you're slowing down. And you do have to work harder. Basically, you become the gear. You become the machine. And you really do feel one with the bike. You feel it through your legs, you feel it through the bike, it's right there. And I mean, it's a beautiful thing too. You do have to love it. And most people I know who really take the time to sort of figure out what it is, do fall in love with it. For like, you know, a flat line like Chicago, it's just about perfect. It's not for everyone, that's all I gotta say.
Naz Hamid is a graphic designer as well as a bike nut. He lives in Chicago. Our story was produced by Jonathan Menhivar, and there's more about fixed gear bikes at studio360.org. You don't need me to tell you about the big summer movies. Hollywood's 24/7 PR marketing machine has made sure that you know War of the Worlds came out this week and that Fantastic Four opens on Friday. So ordinarily, when I tell you about some terrific film I've seen, I tend to talk about smaller ones. You know, the ones that play in just a few dozen theaters instead of a few thousand multiplex screens. But not this time.
What the hell?
Right now, I think it's important to point out that one huge new Hollywood movie is a very good movie.
He's here. Who? The Batman.
Batman Begins is the prequel to the other four Batman movies of the last couple of decades, and it's simply great on its own larger-than-life comic book terms. I think it's better than all of the other superhero movies of the last few years. It perfectly straddles fantasy and reality.
When you told me your grand plan for saving Gotham, the only thing that stopped me from calling the men in white coats was when you said that it wasn't about thrill-seeking.
It's not.
The characters and story and physical details are just plausible enough for me to suspend disbelief. I totally bought the whole vision.
You're getting lost inside this monster of yours.
I'm using this monster to help other people just like my father did.
It heartens me to see a big popcorn movie like this that is so well conceived and so beautifully executed. And since Batman Begins is a huge box office smash, it heartens me also that quality is being rewarded in the marketplace. In fact, so far this summer, it's the only big new movie really drawing people into the theaters.
aside from Star Wars, the only smash hit and the only great film. Coincidence? I don't think so. It looks like the mediocrity of most movies is actually keeping people away from theaters. There's a brand new Associated Press survey out. According to it, 73% of Americans, 3 out of 4 people, now say they prefer to see movies at home, alone, rather than in a real movie theater. Now, the people in the survey weren't asked if they actually prefer to stay at home and watch movies or if they just can't justify the schlep and the expense of going out to movies when most new ones aren't worth going out for. I hope the explanation is the latter. I hope this huge anti-movie theater majority is the result of one too many trips to the multiplex to spend $8 apiece on movies like Monster in Law and Miss Congeniality 2. All I know is, if I'd seen Batman Begins at home on my little TV screen with its little TV speakers, I would have been underwhelmed. And I also would have missed the real delight of being among a satisfied, sold-out audience of happy strangers applauding at the end of a really good movie. This is Kurt Anderson, and you've been listening today to Studio 360. I hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Arun Roth,
David Krasnow,
Lital Malad,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Eric Malinsky,
Melissa O'Donnell,
Owen Agnew.
Special thanks to Brad Tytel. Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
What does a blonde white woman do when she wants to impersonate Michael Jackson?
Strangely, I don't have to do much to look like him. When Michael Jackson's sitting in a tree, he likes to say, "Hello, tree! Hello, birds! Hello, clouds!"
The Art of Parody. I'm Kurt Anderson. Join me and Saturday Night Live's Amy Poehler next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.